hopefully we're going to get the noise taken care of here, so. Why don't you pause a second before you begin? Why don't you proceed, and if we have problems with it, we'll take another pause. I apologize for the condition of things here. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is William Bianco, and I'm here on behalf of 3DS LLC, as well as Keith Donner. Co-counsel is also sharing this time, so I'll take about 5 minutes and leave 5 minutes for him. This case is arbitration is the key issue in this case. And the three areas we need to look at is the plaintiff's actions during this case, the appellee's action during this case, is first one, also the failure to file a motion for stay, and then whether or not federal law preempts the state law. What I'm asking this court to look at is that actions and words speak louder than the underlying statute. This case rides upon whether section 25.2602.202 should control this case, because the arbitration provision in this contract was clearly not underlined. It was bolded, like most standard contracts in the real estate area, but not underlined. When this was case was ordered to arbitration, a full 9 months before it was arbitrated, both parties, the appellees, filed the necessary papers with the arbitration. Discovery was conducted, which took extra long. There was even a continuance granted in the arbitration process. So this case was not rushed to arbitration. It was duly litigated in the arbitration phase with discovery.
Can parties waive the issue of arbitrability by voluntarily participating in an arbitration and not objecting in that arbitration?
Yes, Your Honor. And
is that what happened here?
That is what happened here. And the transcript is clear that the appellees, and as a plaintiff then, did not object, nor, and they also elicited promises from everybody present before the arbitration and during the arbitration that everybody in that room had agreed to be bound by the arbitration. My comment to the arbitrator was, yes, my clients agreed to do that, other than the criteria set forth in my Nebraska law, such as fraud or other aspects of set aside of arbitration. But as far as a normal, typical arbitration decision, everybody agreed to that. We received the arbitration decision, and then they want to again file a motion to reconsider the court's order to arbitrate. Their actions by participating for a full 9 months, and then in addition, they never filed a motion for stay under Nebraska 25-2603, which could have stayed the actions. They only filed motions for reconsideration. We were before Judge Gleason 1 month before the arbitration, and at that point, the record shows that there was nobody talking about the arbitration or staying the arbitration or that the arbitration was around the corner. The proper motion being filed would be a motion to stay arbitration pending the reconsideration of the order. That was never done, Your Honor. They participated voluntarily through the entire process, and the only time they were upset with the process is when they lost. And therefore, I believe that they waived any right to appeal this decision, and I believe that the judge was incorrect in not upholding the arbitration award. And those are the main issues in this case, but there's a lot of cases that discuss arbitration and discuss, you know, language in arbitration, but the real focus of this case are the actual facts, in which show that plaintiff, Nepelli, participated fully in the entire process, failed to object, and also failed to file a motion for stay.
So what is your best case for the proposition that they waived the statutory requirement?
The best case that I cited in my brief, it is definitely not we're talking about underlining, but I believe the promissory estoppel case that I cite in my brief. Sorry, I don't have that cite right in front of me, Your Honor. And also, there's a case out of New York, matter of County of Ogallala, a 1998 count, says that by failing to apply for a stay of arbitration, they waived its potential.
That's waiving the opportunity to submit a stay?
Yes.
But I guess I'm sort of trying to narrow it into, can a party waive the statutory requirement?
I believe so, Your Honor. It is a freedom to contract in the United States, and the freedom to contract, they contracted.
That your proposition is freedom to contract would supersede this advisement warning that's statutory?
No, it is advisement warning, Your Honor, but yeah. It's funny, last night I was reading this statute, 25602.02, which says that the underlined type adjoining signature block should have it underlined. But if you look at the actual statute, it doesn't underline the example. It has bolded that this contract contains an arbitration provision which may be enforced by parties. It's not underlined.
But the language of the statute requires that it be underlined.
Yes, Your Honor.
It references underline, but then it doesn't underline.
Exactly, Your Honor.
All right.
But it was just something ironic I was looking at last night and I'm going that. But also, I want to look at 25260.
So the proposition is waived by irony.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever counsel, works, Your Honor. That's
counsel,
it.
That language in the statute came about to make enforceable agreements in advance of the existence of a dispute to arbitrate a dispute that arises subsequently. Here, the way you are presenting the arguments about what actually transpired at the arbitration, an agreement to arbitrate took place on the record after the dispute arose.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that really outside the scope of that statute?
Exactly, Your Honor. I do believe that. It would be outside the scope. So I believe we have two ways of this court can rule in favor of our client, is that their actions and their waiver occurred outside of the scope of the contract. And with that, I would yield the rest of my time to co-counsel. Thank you very much. I appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ruge, good morning to you.
Good morning. Chief Justice, Justices, Doug Ruge on behalf of the appellant Ryan Bassey. One thing that you know we should stress here is that there is evidence of instruments of interstate commerce, such that the broadest interpretation of the Commerce Clause under Allied Bruce is invoked.
What is the essential nature of the transaction that occurred?
It is a transaction that involved the sale of a residence.
In Nebraska?
Yes.
From one person in Nebraska to someone else in Nebraska?
Yes, utilizing instruments of interstate commerce and...
Well, like the mails, is that what you're talking about?
Talking about the internet. The internet was advertised as property.
Didn't we, in a fairly recent case, emphasize it's not these collateral, what did they use? It's this, and the U.S. Supreme Court has said, has it not, that we look to the essential nature of the transaction. Isn't that right? Well, assume it's right. What's your best argument? What's your best argument that the essential nature of this transaction
there's an opinion to that effect.
Yeah. Was it all interstate in character?
Sure. Well, if you look under Allied Bruce, okay, there was direct evidence in that case that that the product, the termite treatment product, had been purchased at some point. It's not real clear, but it had been purchased at some point in interstate commerce. And therefore, they said under the broad interpretation of the interstate commerce
that was the nature of the transaction, right? That was what was the dispute was about.
Well, I disagree with you that you can just look at, okay, this is just the sale of real estate. You have to look at what's involved in the transaction, okay? And if there is evidence that it, you know, products were purchased that came in interstate commerce, then I think Allied Bruce is applicable. And we have here, we don't have direct evidence that the appliances, for example, that were purchased at Nebraska Furniture Mart came in interstate commerce. We don't have okay, this was Samsung and it was manufactured in Korea. We don't have that here. But the court oftentimes takes common knowledge into consideration. And I think it's fairly common knowledge that the appliances, parts of it at least, and probably all of those, would not have been manufactured and assembled and arose in Nebraska solely.
Is there evidence of a mortgage?
There is. There are evidences both that a mortgage was paid off and that one was taken.
Does that have anything to do with interstate
I believe
towers?
So. And again, you know, we don't have evidence in this case as to, you know, where the funds flowed, where they went to, but I think the court can take common knowledge into consideration that, you know, these transactions don't happen in isolation, that they don't occur within Nebraska circles of commerce.
So are you asking this court to find as a matter of law that all home sales involve interstate commerce?
No, what I'm asking is if there is evidence that there are instruments of interstate commerce that are used, like Allied Bruce, or
what product, evidence do we have here?
Products that were appliances that were purchased from Nebraska Furniture Mart. That's one. We have the emails. We have the internet. We have the products that were put into the home. Now, again, the distinction between this case and maybe Allied Bruce is that we don't have direct evidence that these products were purchased at some point in interstate commerce.
Whose burden is it to put that evidence in to the record?
Well, in hindsight, I would have liked to have done that. But I think the court, in your opinions, Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court opinions, reasonable inferences and common knowledge can be taken into consideration. And I don't think anyone would dispute that those appliances, at least parts of them, if not all of them, were purchased in interstate commerce.
I'm a little confused by the appliance reference. Weren't those appliances that were purchased by the sellers before they listed the home for sale? It was part of fixing the place up and flipping it, right? So this is something that the sellers did before there was an agreement, before there was a purchase agreement, and how should that influence our thinking in any respect?
Yeah. So your position seems to be that you know,
I don't have a position. I'm just asking you to explain.
Yeah, no. Your question is that these were part of the fix-up. They weren't part of the actual contract of sale. And I would disagree because I think the sale was advertised as, you know, a fix-up, that, you know, it was a complete renovation. I don't recall that it's in the evidence that there's a specific reference to the appliances. Certainly.
But I beg your pardon, but you're drilling down and saying the house is full of stuff that was in interstate commerce.
The products of interstate commerce, yes.
Okay. Yeah. But it wasn't, you're not saying this was an appliance sale?
No, it was not an appliance sale.
And what did we say in, is it Charter, West National Bank?
I think so.
Is there anything in that opinion that you wish to respond to?
I don't recall that opinion offhand, so I can't respond to that. So. But I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Eichmann, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Justin Eichmann appearing on behalf of the Garlocks, who were the plaintiffs, as you know, in the case below, and are the appellees in this matter here. Just following up on some questions, I think, that we just finished with Mr. Ruge. With respect to interstate commerce and the nature of the transaction at issue, I think there's a couple things I find fascinating about this case. That I'd like to emphasize. I think, number one, the issue of how the trial court is determined is to determine whether
this is an is a transaction that affects interstate commerce. When is that decision made? Is that a decision that's to be made when the motion to stay the case and compel arbitration is brought? Or is that a decision that's made only after, a year later, after we've actually gone through arbitration, then we have the evidence? The problem with this case is there wasn't any evidence presented in support of the motion to stay or and compel arbitration. So there wasn't anything presented to the court that says, Your Honor, here are the facts that say this involves interstate commerce in some way. They were relying solely on the purchase contract, which was attached to the complaint. It's only after the fact, only after we were actually compelled to go to arbitration, participate in arbitration, that all of these facts that we're now relying on to say, look, it involved interstate commerce, it's only then that these facts come out.
So are you arguing that you had no opportunity to make those arguments before the arbitration, at the time of the motion for stay, that you couldn't have raised those factual matters then?
I think those factual matters could have been raised, but they weren't. I don't think the appellants in this case raised those factual issues by way of an affidavit or testimony or some sort of evidence. They simply relied on, as far as I read the record, they relied on the purchase contract, which was attached as an exhibit to the complaint. So I think the opportunity was there, and I think they could have. And in fact, one of the cases cited by the defendants as authority for the existence of interstate commerce here is the Bezerra case, California case, 98 Cal App 4th, 1205. In that case, you had 60 plaintiffs, essentially, who were suing a home builder for design and construction flaws. Okay, now I think the case is entirely distinguishable on the facts on that basis. However, if you look at the procedure in that case, the defendants, when they came forward to try to compel arbitration and stay the remainder of the case, they brought forward affidavits that said, Here are the subcontractors that are involved and what states they're from. Here's where the materials came from to do all the remodeling work that we contracted to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It came forward with that evidence to show the effect on interstate commerce. And so I think where we're at, I think what the appellants are arguing is that almost any transaction you undergo somehow will involve interstate commerce. And I think that there are a couple of opinions, and one of them that I'd point to that I'd like the court to consider is there's the Sanai case out of Kentucky. It's a federal court case out of Kentucky, 289 F sub 2nd, 855, where I think it gets to the point where some of the questioning was trying to be made here earlier. It says, notwithstanding its congenial effects on interstate commerce, the sale of residential real estate is inherently intrastate. Contracts strictly for the sale of residential real estate focus entirely on a commodity, the land, which is firmly planted in one particular state. The citizenship of the immediate parties, the buyer and the seller, or their movements to or from that state are incidental to the real estate transaction.
So this court has taken up that question recently as well. Isn't that right?
I believe so.
And what did we say?
I believe the case that I just cited is in line with that, with these congenial effects.
What about the issue of waiver?
You know, waiver is very interesting. Another great issue in this case, because I think the important thing to remember is all of the cases for the position that the appellants take on waiver are the opposite of what we have in this case. The cases that are presented on waiver by the appellants essentially say, look, first of all, they all started with a demand for arbitration, which puts someone like my clients in a position to say, okay, do I go along with the arbitration or do I move for a stay of the arbitration because I want whether the matter is arbitrable, I want that to be decided by the court first.
Here, wasn't it your client who initiated the arbitration, sir?
But not until after we filed the case before the trial court. We filed the case before the trial court, which I think by filing it, number one, identified our objection to arbitrating it. Number two, then the appellants come along and ask for the matter to be either dismissed or stayed pending arbitration. We object to that before the district court. Not only do we object to it, but when the ruling comes out that we have to arbitrate it, that the matter is stayed pending arbitration.
I'm going to stop you right there. Did the judge's order stay it and say you must go to arbitration, or did the judge's order stay it and say, hey, there's a paragraph in this contract that says either you mediate, and if you don't settle it some other way, you go to binding arbitration?
Correct. The latter.
So is it fair to characterize this as an order compelling arbitration or as a stay to permit either mediation or arbitration and to let the parties choose?
I think
which is more accurate?
I think the latter is more accurate, Your Honor.
So in this case, that choice was allowed the parties and your client chose to arbitrate?
Right. However, from that order, I think the whether it's explicitly laid out in there, the message from the trial court at that point is your only remedy is either mediate it or arbitrate it. And so the case was stayed so we could do exactly that. Now, what we did, what the appellees did is we went ahead and filed an arbitration because of the time frame involved and the need to get that on file. But at the same time, we also filed a motion asking for a rehearing, asking for that matter to be reconsidered and raised again.
Did you tell the judge that you had an arbitration scheduled about a month out and ask that there be an order to stay that?
No, I don't believe we did. I don't believe we identified it. I think the appellant's counsel's recollection as to the record is correct on that. I don't think we identified it.
And did the arbitrator make a specific finding about that? Didn't the arbitrator address that in the award? That there was no request in the arbitration to stay it and no order presented staying it, therefore they were going to go forward?
He did. Although I think the arbitrator also did acknowledge that we did advise him that we were continuing to request reconsideration of that issue in front of the trial court.
Was there anything that compelled you to go through with the arbitration? Could you have said to the arbitrator, hold up, we're trying to stop this whole thing. Let's not go through with an arbitration when we might not be compelled to do it?
I think we could have. I mean,
And if you could have, then does this fall within our rule that you were basically gambling on a favorable result, and then when you didn't get it, you can go back to the court and say, hey, vacate this thing?
No, I don't think so. Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think the issue here is, I think we made it clear before the trial court that we didn't think we had to arbitrate it. We didn't think the arbitration agreement was enforceable. We continued to press the trial court for a determination on that issue. That alone, I think, advised the rest of the parties what our position was on that. I think on top of that, whether we asked for a stay or not, we did advise the arbitration that we were continuing to essentially pester the trial court for a determination of whether or not we had to arbitrate it. And I think...
Well, on a motion to reconsider.
Yes.
The stay.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, yes.
I just want to be sure we're talking about the same proceeding. There were a lot of motions in this case.
Yes, there were a ton of motions in this case, and we are on the same page there. And I think in my brief, I tried to present a number of cases that I think have at least tangentially dealt with this issue so that we can maybe try to extrapolate what the rule is in this case. And I think all of them identify... The only bright line rule that I've been able to find is that if you don't raise the issue of arbitrability before a district court and you don't object to the arbitration, if you don't do both of those, if you don't do either of those things, then you can't argue the issue later on.
Could you fast forward a little bit here to the order
that's
before us, which in effect just talks about the underlining of the notice?
Yeah.
Was that waived? Can the statutory requirement be waived?
I don't believe it can. And I think that's important. I think some of the case law, in some of the questioning previously, there was some discussion on the case law around why it is that we have this lettering in caps and underlined. I mean, I think as long as, those issues are present, we can waive rights to have a jury trial or go to the district court for relief. But absent that, I don't think we can waive it. And I don't think we did in this case, though, either.
I think Justice Castle has suggested that this, the font size and all that is puts folks on notice on the front side.
Correct.
Okay. Well, why would that be relevant to the way the facts ensued here?
Well, perhaps you can waive it. I don't know what the answer to that question is. Perhaps you can waive it after the fact, but I don't think that's what happened here. I think the best reading for the appellants in favor of us having waived it is that we went around and asked everybody whether they would consent to the binding nature of arbitration, if that's the direction it was going to go. And the reason we did, I think the reason that was done is because two of the parties to this case were not parties to the purchase contract that had the arbitration clause in it.
And those two nevertheless agreed on the record to be bound by the arbitration.
As I understand it, ultimately they did. However, there was a lot of discussion back and forth on whether they would or not.
And your client was concerned about that. Isn't that why you asked that the record be made, so you weren't wasting your time in arbitration?
Well, correct. But also, you know, I think my client's walking a fine line here, which is, on the one hand, trying to assert its rights in the district court, but also trying to abide by what the district court would like it to do as far as arbitration is concerned, and trying to walk this line until it can get a decision as to whether or not it ever had to go to arbitration in the first place. So, thank you for your time. Your Honors, I appreciate your consideration in this matter and ask that the award be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? No, there is no time.